This is a podcast from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute that explores budget policies and issues affecting low and moderate income Americans.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. The president has signed the health care bill and tomorrow plans to sign the reconciliation bill. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the bill will reduce the deficit by $143 billion over the first 10 years and about one-half of 1% of GDP, which translates into about $1.3 trillion over the second decade. This is a marked departure from big measures passed over the previous decades, like the prescription drug bill and tax cuts, that were deficit-financed rather than paid for. But claims are now being made that the CBO cost estimates for the health reform legislation give a misleading picture, that the cost estimate is skewed by various gimmicks, that part of the bill is a new Ponzi scheme, and that the bill is really a large deficit increaser. These claims were on full display yesterday on Sunday talk shows and are now popping up in various recent op-eds and columns. To assess these claims, we have with us here today three of the city's leading and most respected budget experts, Jim Horney, Paul Vandewater, and, of course, Bob Reischauer. Jim and Paul, who are two former senior CBO officials, now here at the Center on Budget, have analyzed every one of these claims in detail. Last Thursday, we released their analysis, which is on our website, in which I commend you. It finds that every one of these claims is either misleading or flatly inaccurate. In just a minute, we'll hear from Jim and Paul. And then we'll turn to Bob Reischauer. Bob is both the former director of the Congressional Budget Office and until a year or so ago, vice chair of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, Congress's official expert advisory panel on Medicare payments. He's also president of the Urban Institute. He's a leading expert on both the budget and health care, and I know of no one more widely respected across the political spectrum. When they're finished, we'll go to your questions. We start with Jim Horney.
Thank you, Bob. We put out our paper last week in an effort to try once again to set the record straight. One of the most frustrating aspects of the health reform debate is that many critics of health reform seem immune to evidence that their arguments are factually incorrect. One big example of this is the argument that, despite CBO's estimate to the contrary, health reform will actually increase the deficit because future Congresses will never let the Medicare savings that help pay for health reform go into effect. And the argument that we know that will happen because they never have let promised savings go into effect in the past. This is just plain wrong. In fact, Congress has allowed the overwhelming majority of Medicare savings promised over the last two decades, hundreds of billions of dollars, to be implemented as promised. Paul Vandewater and I issued a report 3 months ago that was based on a careful analysis of all major Medicare legislation enacted in the last two decades, and no one has challenged any of the facts we presented. We found that from 1990 to the present, four pieces of legislation with substantial Medicare savings were enacted. In three of those cases, reconciliation bills in 1990, 1993, and 2005, virtually all of the promised savings went into effect as planned. In one case, the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, Congress subsequently did scale back some Medicare provisions. But there were extraordinary circumstances in the next few years after that legislation was enacted in 1997. First, the budget was balanced the very next year, well ahead of the 2002 target date that the VBA assumed. Second, the growth of Medicare spending declined much more than was anticipated when the VBA was enacted. In fact, in 1999, for the first time in history, Medicare spending was actually lower in dollar terms than it was the year before. It is not surprising, therefore, that Congress and the President scaled back some of the Medicare savings that had been enacted. What is surprising is that, given the circumstances, they let nearly four-fifths of the promised savings take effect as planned. Let me talk for a minute about the so-called sustainable growth rate, or SGR, provision that was enacted as part of the VBA. The SGR is a formula that was supposed to limit the growth of rates paid to physicians for the Medicare services they provide. You probably know about the SGR because Congress has taken action repeatedly since 2001 to keep the cuts required by that formula from fully taking effect. The critics of health reform who argue that Congress will not let the Medicare savings in health reform take effect often use the SGR as a prime example of Congress promising big savings they never let go into effect. This claim ignores several inconvenient facts. First, Congress did not promise big savings from the SGR. The SGR was expected to produce only very modest savings, only $12 billion over 10 years. That's less than 5% of the total Medicare savings estimated just for the VBA of 1997, and a much smaller portion of the total Medicare savings estimated from that legislation and the 1993 and 2005 reconciliation bills. Second, because the SGR was badly designed, we later learned that it would require cuts far in excess of what had been anticipated and would reduce reimbursement rates below what physicians needed just to cover their costs. Finally, while Congress and the President have not allowed the full SGR cuts to go into effect, the cuts they have imposed in its place have reduced physician reimbursement rates by 17% below the level in effect in 2001, adjusted for inflation. The bottom line is that the SGR experience is not an example of Congress caving in to undue pressure from providers and reneging on big promised savings. Let me turn to Paul to talk about some of the other claims of health reform critics that do not withstand scrutiny.
Thanks, Jim. I will now go through four more claims one by one and explain why they too are not correct. Claim number one, Congress front-loaded the savings in the health reform legislation and backloaded the costs so that, by implication, the legislation will increase the deficit in the long run. That's wrong. Yes, certain ones of the saving provisions in the bill kick in before the coverage expansions take effect, but there are other provisions that do not take effect until later. For example, the excise tax on high-cost health plans. When CBO looks at the legislation as a whole, it finds that health reform reduces the deficit by far more in its second 10 years than in its first 10 years. And CBO projects that the bill will continue to reduce the deficit in later years as well. Claim two, the health reform legislation uses revenues from Social Security and premiums from long-term care insurance to offset the cost of health reform. That's wrong as well. The numbers in the CBO cost estimate readily disprove this claim. Congressional leaders deliberately crafted the health reform legislation so that it would be fully paid for without relying on additional Social Security payroll tax revenues or premium contributions for the CLASS Act for new long-term care insurance programs. CBO estimates that health reform will reduce the deficit by $143 billion over its first 10 years. Leave out net revenues of $29 billion from Social Security and also exclude $70 billion from the CLASS Act. That still leaves $44 billion in deficit reduction, even without counting Social Security or CLASS. In other words, none of the $70 billion in premiums for long-term care insurance is used to pay for health reform. And claims like those made on Sunday's talk shows, this constitutes a Ponzi scheme, with the premiums raided to pay for health reform, are flatly and demonstrably wrong. Claim number three, savings in the Medicare program are being double counted. That's also wrong. The fact is that the Medicare savings and Medicare tax increases included in health reform have two different but equally real effects. First, in the context of the federal budget, these changes help pay for the cost of expanding health coverage and contribute to overall deficit reduction. That's confirmed by CBO's cost estimate. Second, in the context of Medicare's Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, these provisions reduce expenditures from the fund or increase its income, thereby increasing the balances in the fund and prolonging the life of the fund. This conclusion is confirmed by the Office of the Actuary at CMS, which has estimated that health reform will extend the life of the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund by roughly 10 years, from 2017 without health reform to about 2027 with health reform. By the way, CBO accounted for deficit reduction in exactly this way in previous Congresses under both political parties. For example, the Balanced Budget Act of 1997 and the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, both of which were passed by Republican Congresses, included Medicare savings that improved Medicare's solvency, but were also counted as deficit reduction and were also used to offset part of the cost of tax cuts included in companion legislation. No one raised claims of double counting when these earlier bills were enacted. Claim number four, the cost estimate for health reform is too low because it does not include the cost of fixing the sustainable growth rate formula for physicians, which Jim has just discussed. Wrong again. The cost estimate doesn't include lots of things, like the cost of extending unemployment insurance benefits or paying for the war in Afghanistan. And for exactly the same reasons, the cost of fixing the sustainable growth rate formula is unrelated to health reform. Indeed, it seems likely that Congress will never let the full SGR cuts take effect, and it probably won't offset the cost of overriding them. But that cost is in no way a result of health reform. The federal government will incur the cost of fixing the SGR formula regardless of health reform, not because of it. Even if health reform had not been enacted, the cost of fixing SGR would remain. To be sure, we at the Center believe that it would be better if Congress offset the cost of canceling the SGR cuts, but that issue is separate and distinct from the question of how much health reform itself reduces the deficit. Finally, despite charges to the contrary, the health reform legislation contains a wide range of measures to reform the health care system and moderate the growth of health care costs, especially in Medicare. Jim and I listed many of them in our December paper. As a Goldman Sachs analyst recently wrote, these sorts of changes are in some ways the most important aspect of the bill. In the absence of comprehensive health reform, these changes could not have been enacted. Certainly, policymakers will ultimately have to do much more to restrain health care costs, but the legislation starts to move in nearly all the areas that look promising. Healthcare experts agree that slowing the growth of healthcare costs will require an ongoing process of testing, experimentation, and rapid implementation of what works. Enactment of health reform begins that process. Now let me turn things over to Bob Reichauer.
Thank you. Jim and Paul have just reviewed in detail the claims of those that argue that contrary to the CBO cost estimate, health reform will not reduce the deficit, they've shown you why these claims are either wrong or irrelevant. It's worth remembering that there's considerable degree of uncertainty around all CBO estimates, and estimates of systemic health reform are particularly difficult to make and therefore particularly uncertain. But uncertainty means that the measures that are included in this legislation to produce savings or reduce costs could reduce the deficit more than CBO has estimated or less than CBO has estimated. In recent days, attention has focused on the comments of those who think CBO's estimates of the law's impact on the deficit are too generous. But it's worth remembering that there are many who claim CBO has been too cautious or conservative in scoring the savings that will result from health reform. While the critics who say that CBO has overestimated savings tend to be budget or political experts, not really steeped in health analysis. Those who claim that the savings will be greater than CBO has estimated tend to be health experts. For example, John Gable, who's a health and benefit expert who's now at the National Opinion Research Center, published a study in the late fall, one that was summarized in a New York Times op-ed, that examined CBO's record of scoring health-saving initiatives and concluded that CBO tends to be too conservative. In other words, it underestimates the amount of savings or deficit reduction that the legislation has produced. The poster child for CBO's cost estimates being too low or saving too little, of course, is the Medicare prescription drug legislation, which turned out to be less costly than most people, including CBO, thought. David Cutler, who's a highly respected health economist and former dean of social science at Harvard, has written extensively about CBO's estimates of the current health reform legislation, pointing out that, in his opinion, the cost savings will be much larger than CBO has estimated. A third health expert who is also on this side of the argument, Judy Fader, former dean of the Georgetown Public Policy Program and an individual who's been involved in health policy for several decades, also feels that the bill is going to end up saving a whole lot more than CBO and others have projected. Finally, I'd like to say that I think as the economy recovers, we're going to be moving into a period of significant fiscal pressure where market forces are going to drive policymakers to do all they can to reduce the size of the deficit. And in this climate, it's going to be very unlikely that Congress and future administrations will renege on laws that are in place, commitments that they've made to reduce savings or increase revenues. In fact, if anything, I think we're likely to see Congress and future administrations build on the saving measures that were included in this bill, strengthen them, and move forward. So the idea that political pressures are going to be such that Congress will not stick to its commitments, I think, are wrong. With that, let me turn this back to Bob.
Thanks. Operator, please open the lines for questions. As you do, just a few quick comments. Like some of you, perhaps, I was struck by Senator Lindsey Graham's comments yesterday on the talk shows, where he referred to the new long-term care insurance program in the bill as a Ponzi scheme. He argued that the $70 billion in premiums to be paid in the next coming years into the program would effectively be rated and used to pay for health care, leaving the insurance, the new long-term insurance program, without funding and creating the Ponzi scheme. In this case, I think as Paul has indicated, the argument that this is a Ponzi scheme is as clearly wrong as the death panel charge over the summer. If not a single dollar of the $70 billion goes to pay for the health care bill, and Paul showed it doesn't, the CBO estimate shows it doesn't, then obviously there is no rating of those premiums. There is no Ponzi scheme. But there's a broader point here, which is the larger attack is that the long-term care insurance component of this bill is a new entitlement program putting greater strains on the budget on top of all entitlements we already have. Here, too, a look at the program gives you a very different result. Budget experts have worried for years that as the boomers retired, there would be pressure on the government to spend more money to help cover long-term insurance costs. And George W. Bush, as president, repeatedly proposed taxpayer-funded, deficit-financed tax deductions for the purchase of long-term care insurance. Yet what we have in this bill is something very different. There is no taxpayer subsidy. The premiums for the long-term care insurance would be set at whatever it takes to cover 100% of the costs. This is the first time I remember in which a new benefit of sorts was created for the elderly where 100% of the cost is covered by the beneficiary's premiums and the taxpayers don't pick up part of the bill. So the reality here is very different than the presentation we're getting.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. You can follow us on Twitter at Center on Budget, find us on Facebook, or create a MyCenter account at centeronbudget.org.